that's the way we Americans feel so often about the Russians. What are they getting at? Why can't we approach these people? We've tried appeasement. We tried winning them over. We tried allaying their suspicions. We tried buying them off. So when Senator McMahon says $50 billion, we tried that. We gave them $11 billion worth of goods during the war, called Lend-Lease. We gave them in Berlin concession after concession to win them over. Political concessions in the Baltic, in the Balkans. Let them break their agreements one after another, and still we tried to win them over. We tried to understand them. Recognized communist governments which were simply stooges. Agreed to coexistence finally when we couldn't get them to work on a united Germany except on their terms. Then we tried what Vyshinsky is now holding out as bait, coexistence. In other words, good neighbors, well, we can't do anything about it. Let them run ours, we'll run theirs. It wouldn't do. They armed troops in Korea. They said, get out. It's all done now. And then the troops armed by them in the north swept down to take over the whole country, which they hadn't been able to get by other means. Use of force. Berlin, they tried to seize Berlin and drive us out. Use of force. The airlift you know of, which helped us to win that particular scrap. Why won't they behave? What do they want? What are they after? We want nothing from them. We'd like their friendship, but even that, we're willing to coexist. We'll leave them alone. It won't work here, or it won't work in Shanghai, Africa, the United States, or any place. Regardless of what Stalin may say today to mislead us, there can be no short target for them except world control. Now, they don't expect it all tomorrow, but they've got it all planned, and they're working on it. As General Khodorkov said to me one day, I said, oh, let's stop arguing about class struggle. Let's settle this trolley car problem. And I said, neither you nor I will live to see the end of class struggle. As a matter of fact, I think there are a lot of good things about class struggle. Well, he said, I don't know about you, General Howley, but I'll live to see the end of it. Absolutely sure, said themselves. And the plans are made. Now, if you know Berlin, you know it all over the world. Yeah, the pattern changes slightly, but it's basically the same pattern. Now, what is it? What do they want? They want economic and political control of the world. And if you want to read their writings, you can find out. They've documented what they're going to do far more than Hitler did in Mein Kampf. Far more. It's all there. And then you've got all of these cases to back it up. So if we don't know now what they're up to, God help us. We never will. Politically, I'm going to divide what they want in world control into political and economic, because that's the way we think. It's all one to them. I was talking to a Russian general one day, and I said, from what you say, it seems as though food is political. He said, of course. Well, I said, are the police political? Why? He said, naturally. I said, is the control of trolleys political? Why? He said, my dear colonel, of course. I said, how about your Russian army? Is that purely political? He said, we've had enough of the discussion. Or again, talking with Russian general, I think it was Colonel General Gorbatov, I said, look, you got to separate the economic and political on this, and I'll shorten the discussion. He said, how can you separate the economic and political? See? So when I separate it to you and say what it is, it's simply for our thinking. Politically, they want complete control, and this is the way it works any place they are. Control of the government, of course. Get it by election if you can, rig it up, twist it, use food, anything, but control the government. But you don't have to have full control. They had 1/3 in Czechoslovakia. They only had 19% in Berlin. But control of the government. Second, control of the trade unions, because under a democratic system, trade unions can pull a strike and make a government that's not doing what they want fall, you see. So they control those. Remember the CGT strike in Paris, which was intended to make the government fall, which wanted to cooperate with us on the Marshall Plan. Third, control of the police. Because if you control police, they may be soldiers like the Volkspolizei in Germany, but you've got the only people with guns. And therefore, even a minority government of the communists stays in power, and it doesn't matter what you think, you in that area, because they've got the guns and they'll use them. That's the reason after they pull the coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia, you saw the people lined up at Jan Masaryk's funeral crying that their democracy, which was established really with our assistance and which they loved, was being crushed by a very small minority. But every once a while in that lineup, you saw a very straight-faced soldier, man or woman with a gun, didn't you? Well, try your eyes out, little Czech. It won't make a bit of difference. The government will remain communist, and you can't change it by ballot or anything else when they have the guns. Fourth, they want control of the judiciary. Because if you control the judiciary, you can dress up murder and make it look legal, and they love the garbs of legality. The latest note from China, the United Nations is illegal. Favorite, always talking about legality. I always call them a bunch of ambulance chasing lawyers. Because law doesn't even follow logic as ours does. They follow sophistry. They'll play on words, anything to win an advantage, confuse the issue. Now, they're the big four, and then they move on to others. Now, in Berlin, we found they had that, and when they couldn't keep it, that's when they used force to drive us out. On the economic side, it's take. You know the old jokes about what's yours is, what's mine's mine, what's yours will divide. There's a lot of truth in it. Now, I don't know whether it's because the Russians are dumb and need all these goods. For a long time, they used to say they were doing it because of what the Germans took from them. I don't know whether it's because communism doesn't produce goods, and I don't think it does. I think that's a basic weakness in their policy, just as a dictatorship today doesn't produce goods. And when I was in school, we learned that a dictatorship was the most efficient form of government, but it was dangerous because it could go bad. It isn't today, but again, that's another story. Observing these people, economically, they take. That's a reason as soon as the Chinese communist chief went to Moscow, a trade agreement. As soon as they got control of Czechoslovakia, trade agreements. They go hand in hand. They take. Just to give you an illustration, in Berlin, before they let us in, they stripped everything they could move. Berlin Vest, for example, which is in the British sector. We turned over the rich provinces of Saxony and Thuringia with crops in the field, machinery, warehouses bulging. We didn't take a thing because it was going to be their area. When we got to Berlin, they'd stripped everything. They even stripped the Singer Sewing Machine Company. Am I talking too fast? Then they tried to get control of all of the businesses in the city, even after we were there, what was left. Of course, we balked at that. I sent for a legal decision whether they could buy these properties with phony money in 40 corporations, and the lawyers were arguing, so after 2 weeks, I issued an order, no. And then the others followed it, and that's still in effect. But in the Soviet sector, Berlin alone, the 27 biggest corporations are now Soviet AGs. Simply, they say, we own them now. And on their masthead are a couple Russian directors. 364 of the biggest plants are working exclusively for their export. Now, what is this take? That's reparation from current production. You hear it discussed. They went through three phases on this economic take in Germany. First, they stripped everything they could get. And we gave them quite a few things from the West on the basis of making up for what harm the Germans did to them. They shipped it to Russia and couldn't make it run. Now, again, I don't care. I don't care. You can say they couldn't make it run for a lot of reasons. Maybe it was because combat troops ripped it out. I went over and saw flat cars loaded with precision tools, and my engineer said useless after 2 days exposed to weather. Anyhow, they shipped them to their satellites into Russia and couldn't make the machinery run. Next, forced labor. They took one morning at between 2 and 4 out of their sector, Berlin, because they didn't dare come into mine, something like 440 people, technicians, electrical workers, and shipped them to Russia. That was phase two, trying to get the workers to run the machinery in Russia. They still couldn't do it. Third, whatever machinery remains in Germany, leave it there, leave the workers who are still there, and take what they produce. That's reparations from current production, you see. Now, we say no to it. They demanded approximately $10 billion worth of such goods from Germany as one of the prices for a united Germany. And we said no because there's no point in our pouring in billions. In order to lift the economic level of Germany up to the point where Germany is not an economic cesspool in Europe, no use our pouring it in if it goes out the other side. See? So having been denied it for all Germany, they've taken over $9 billion worth of such goods out of just the part they could get their hands on, which is East Germany, where there are about 18 million people living. That's a reason East Germany is awfully, awfully poor. It's one reason. And the West is going up. Well, I think I find time races along. They used force in Berlin. They used force in Korea. Do they want war? Do they want force? No, not for itself. They don't have the dread of force or of death that we do. They don't have the sensitivity. Now, I don't know whether that's communistic or whether it's Asiatic. Again, I'm much more on the objective psychology than the subjective, meaning what goes on in their heads, why they do it. And we've had enough observation now to judge them by what they have done. Berlin, they used force. The blockade was a means of doing three things for them. They hadn't been able to get the controls, economic and political, so they clamped on a brutal blockade, a strangulation of the Western sectors, which made the black hole of Calcutta look like child's play. We are getting so immune to inhumanity in the world that we put up with it. There have been wars and all kinds of things. We're so accustomed to it now, we really accept it philosophically. A whole Chinese army marches in and butchers Americans in a surprise attack, and we refer it and start writing letters on it. We're getting calloused. Anyhow, they wanted to do three things. One, they wanted to seize Berlin because it's valuable for a lot of reasons, economic and political. That'd make us go out, because the people, when they started to starve, would say, gee, we like the Western ideas. We have opposed the communist minority, which had sunk down to 3%. But we have to eat. Our families have to eat. Please go so we can live. Or they'd obey the Russian propaganda and riot, you see. And then the Russians could move in troops, because Berlin is 100 miles inside of area occupied by the Russian soldiers. Second, they wanted us to leave Berlin to run out. And if we had, our world leadership would have received a death blow. Because the first time someone threatened us, if we ran out, naturally nobody's going to tie up with us. And third, they wanted to see how effective their propaganda was, whether it was true or not. You know, they get to believe these things themselves. A lot like the American Indians before a battle, going around pounding, you know, and whooping it up, I'm the greatest fellow, I'm going to lift 15 scalps. And after they've gone around and said it enough, they sort of have mesmerism or whatever it is, or it's some sort of a twisting. They begin to believe it, you see. And the Indian go off then, he'd get in a fight, and maybe he'd lose his scalp, or maybe he'd win a couple. But they talk so much about us that they wanted to see if, really, we wouldn't fight. It's that simple with them. Our men won't fight for anything. We could be bought off, you see. And second, whether economically we're on the verge of collapse. And of course, I'm not going to deal with the blockade, because you know the story. I was on the ground. We worked out. First place we knew it was coming, I'll tell you that. That's the reason we had time for an airlift. As early as in March, I knew what their pattern was. I have to say I, because I went up and reported it and went to Washington. You see, we'd been watching after the conference of foreign ministers broke up in London, which gave them notice we would no longer go to a conference and simply rubber stamp their desires. So we're all waiting for them to get some kind of orders. And finally, when they sat down to confer that day, I knew they had their orders. They'd changed their political advisor from a persuasive Litvinov type to this Maximov, wise, tough guy, and so forth. The general was reduced to the position of reading prepared statements. So well, there were a lot of signs. Anyhow, I reported it. Immediately, I got our experts, and we had some good ones there on economics and food and welfare and everything. We planned. What would happen if they tried to blockade us? I had reported the Russians are going to do three things. They're going to break up the German government they agreed to establish and support. They're going to break up the Berlin military four-power headquarters, which is the basis of our having given them Saxony and Thuringia, and they're going to take steps to get us out. I didn't know what the steps would be, but I advised getting women and children out and bringing in a few more fighters, make it worthwhile. Based on that, I had a secret meeting with the British and French general in my home. If it were known, then the Russians would use that as an excuse, you see, for doing what they wanted to do. We had a secret meeting. I said, here's the assumption, these 3 points. And I said, we better get ready, and here's a study. I want you to know, it's marked top secret, and it's in my safe. The French general, General Gonval, said, I don't think they'd dare do it to the Western powers, but it's well to be prepared, they're capable of it. The British general had one of these guards' mustaches. He says, preposterous, they wouldn't dare do it, see. I love to kid the Englishmen especially. They wear their handkerchiefs in here and all that stuff. But make no mistake, there's no fighter in the world tougher than an Englishman. They'll negotiate up, though, and it'll break your heart the last minute. But they'll fight, and they'll fight for about the same things we will. We all chipped in, and we got ready for what we knew was coming. So when it came at the end of June, we had 36 days' supply of food, 6 weeks' supply of power, coal, for pumping the sewers and pumping water. It takes 110 tons of coal a day to pump this water up from 1,300 wells and so forth. That gave us time to think and make plans, you see. So the airlift came in then. Finally, we'd won a great victory. We'd succeeded in going through a winter. We had new airfields built by hand. The first airfield out in Tegel in the French sector, we had 17,000 people working with scoops and shovels by hand because you couldn't fly in heavy machinery.